This is Defenders United. Sunday, March 12th, 2017. It's my first 24 hours in the magical city of New Orleans. I got a tip from a local that there are second lines most every Sunday in the spring, and that I should make it a priority to experience one. So, after grabbing a shrimp po' boy from a little place on North Rampart near my hostel, I followed the sound of brass horns to the Treme to see what they were all about. For the rest of us in America, the closest thing we have to a second line is a parade. But a second line is so much more. It's a parade with a mind and spirit of its own. Also, no one stands on the sidewalk and watches. If you're going to a second line, you become part of it, following the brass band through the streets with a groove in your step and a drink in your hand. As I soon found out, that particular second line was in memory of a young man from the neighborhood who had recently been shot. The people were coming together not only against the terrors of gun violence that took his life, but also against the lack of economic opportunity in the city, it seemed. One woman holding a sign that said, 39% of New Orleans youth living in poverty. A man standing next to her held a sign with the words, 52% of black men unemployed. This juxtaposition of celebration and mourning, joy and pain, seemed to be the essence of my time in New Orleans. Although I only spent a week there in March, I eventually returned in June to work as a summer law clerk at Orleans Public Defenders. It was there that I was able to sit down with attorney Will Snowden to discuss his work as a public defender in this inimitable city. Will is a prolific storyteller, a skill that no doubt serves him well in his roles as litigator in court and traveling educator in his nonprofit. He attributes his passion for advocacy in part to watching his mother fight for him during his childhood. Will is black and biracial, the child of a black father and white mother. He grew up in a Wisconsin suburb called
Wauwatosa.
Wauwatosa.
Which is a mouthful. I don't know what Wauwatosa means, but yeah, I grew up in Milwaukee in a suburb area called Wauwatosa. Wauwatosa didn't have as high of a black population as Milwaukee, the actual city, did. One thing that Milwaukee used to be called was the Selma of the North, and that it's very segregated, like Selma, Alabama was. Mm-hmm. And when I was growing up, that was apparent as far as how the city was divided racially. Mm-hmm. There was a program in the Department of Education called the 220 program, which essentially, as I remember it, I would describe it as forced integration. Essentially, kids from Milwaukee were bused to suburb schools and kind of vice versa. And so I went to... For elementary school, I went to Milwaukee Public Schools, but then for middle school and high school, I went to the Wauwatosa suburb schools. And the number of students of color at the middle school and high school were definitely smaller and fewer than my elementary experience. And the way that the city was divided racially would come out in conversations with students. If I were to reference like a restaurant on 76 and Capitol called Checkers, here in New Orleans it's called Rallies, but they're the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. To some of the white kids in my class, they didn't know what I was talking about because they didn't come below like maybe 84th and Capitol. For some of them, you know, some of them knew the entire city, but I remember referencing certain parts of Milwaukee that they just simply didn't know about because they didn't go to that part of town. So there was always just kind of this idea of the division within Milwaukee, and for the most part, the students of color were the ones that caught the bus to school, mm-hmm. and there was like this forced integration process because where the actual high school was located, there weren't a lot of students of color or families of color in that area. Okay. My high school, I think, was around 2,000 kids, and one of my first experiences, freshman year, was running cross country. It was like I don't know why I got into running, because mm-hmm. I didn't run in middle school or anything like that, but mm-hmm. I think in my mind I wanted to lose some of my like chubby weight. I wasn't like overweight, but I was just, I don't know, it was just kind of weird.
Yeah.
So I figured, hey, you know, I'll start running. And interestingly, or not surprisingly, I was the slowest in the group because everybody probably ran before.
And yeah.
Wauwatosa is next to another suburb called Brookfield, And Brookfield is kind of a very affluent suburb. And we would run into Brookfield and kind of run back to Tulsa. I went to Wauwatosa West High School. And there's Wauwatosa West and there's Wauwatosa East. Mm-hmm. Call it Tulsa West or Tulsa East. Mm-hmm. If you're in Wauwatosa, you just refer to East or West. So I'm running cross-country practice. We ran into Brookfield, and I'm by myself, and this cop pulls up to me. And he says, "Why are you running so fast?" And I look at my shirt, which has the Universal Cross Country symbol on it, the CC with an arrow through it. And I look at these short shorts that I'm wearing that no one would, with any type of self-respect, would wear if they weren't in cross-country practice. And I just kind of look at my outfit, or lack thereof, and I go, "I'm running cross-country practice. Like, what are you talking about?" And he goes, "Likely story." So obviously he thought that I was in the neighborhood up to some type of criminal activity. And I was just very, very upset. And so I run back. Eventually I get back to the high school. I tell my coach about it. Coach is upset. Tell my parents about it. And they don't stand for stuff like that. So we hop in the car. It was actually a minivan. Hop in the minivan with my oldest sister and my parents, and we drive to Brookfield. And it's probably about a 30-minute drive from our house. And we get to the police station, and my mom is white and my dad is black. And so there have been numerous experiences in my life where people will see us but don't realize we're a family, right? That this unit, this multicultural unit, you know, couldn't be a family for a lot of these people. So we get into the police station, go to the front desk, and my dad is upset. He's kind of not yelling at the guy, but being vocal with him. Like, we need to speak with, you know, some type of rank or lieutenant or whatever. My mom has a similar complaint. They're both just like going at this guy. And they tell my dad to wait. They're going to be with this lady first, talking about my mom. And she ends up speaking with a lieutenant, and they are like, "Well, we want to speak to your son." And then they realize that we're all a family, and they realize that my dad was, you know, complaining about the same thing. So they take me to some interrogation room, and my mom was very adamant that you weren't going to be speaking to my son without, you know, a parent there. So mom goes back, and they start asking me questions, and they ask me what direction I was running. And everybody knows at my high school is called West. So I said, I was running towards West. And because he knew I was a Wauwatosa West High School student. So he's like, you know, interesting, because North Avenue, which was a street that I got stopped on, runs north and south. So he's like, you can't be running west on North Avenue. And I'm like, and mind you, I'm a freshman. So I'm like, looking at him like, you're an idiot, right? And like, what are you, you're trying to catch me up on this small little technicality. And my mom isn't really feeling it. And the lieutenant then goes on to say that they had a witness not stop and talk to me. So mom was like, "Well, how'd you canvass for that?" Right? And in her mind, she's thinking, like, did you knock on doors and say, "Hey, did you see this cop not stop and talk to this young black kid?" No. Like, he just, people don't notice things not happening. You know what I mean? Right. And I couldn't process it at that age, like what she was getting at, but now in hindsight, it makes sense. And essentially the lieutenant was saying I was making up this whole story. And my mom goes, you know, I agree with you, kids lie, but they typically lie to gain something, like for some type of advantage. But what do I gain from making up this story? I was already slow. Everybody knew I was slow. And like, I didn't need to make up a story getting right. stopped by police for why I couldn't complete this time any faster, yeah. you know, running with the group. And my mom takes out her checkbook, and, you know, checkbooks, they still do, but a lot of us don't use checkbooks anymore. They have calendars in them at the top. And she takes out her checkbook, and she literally counts the days, and she tells the lieutenant something along the lines of, like, if you don't issue my son an apology, you'll see this paper in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Like, she's counting the days. She's like, by Friday. And I just remember that image of my mom just, like, being such a boss, you know? And where I didn't have any type of authority or comfort level telling this cop to this lieutenant that, you know, he was in the wrong and so was, you know, the cop that stopped me. And I think that experience, like seeing somebody fight for me, and there's other stories like that. You know, my parents are just great in so many different ways of them fighting for me and my sisters mm-hmm. when we were mistreated either in school or in the city or trying to go to the bowling alley, whatever it might be. Just always having them fight for me is something that I'll always remember. I think for me, that experience, you know, being in a position where I didn't know what was going on, and police officers are very intimidating, and just seeing them and their willingness, my parents' willingness to go tell them that they were in the wrong, at the time taught me a lesson of being able to challenge authority. I don't think I had that idea, you know, or even that having the audacity to do that, or the strength to do that. And there have just been different instances where things happen to me. I would tell my parents and they'd say, no, that's wrong. Okay. And maybe in the moment I didn't realize it was wrong, but they kind of, you know, rescued me, or they were my champions. They were my defenders.
After college, Will relocated to the East Coast for work and ultimately for law school, where he enrolled at Seton Hall University School of Law in Newark, New Jersey.
So academically, I loved law school. Mm-hmm. I thought I learned so many things, like how to be an adult. And I remember being in property class and calling my mom and being like, you know, when we had the problem with the sewer and the neighbors were using our drainage pipe, and like, you know, just going over all this stuff. He's like, not really. I was like, but that's, you know, they had an easement on our property. Like, you're trying to apply all these facts to like our childhood. And I'm just like, what are you talking about? You know? So academically, I really enjoyed law school. I went to Seton Hall Law School, which is in Newark, New Jersey. And, you know, I've been an attorney for almost 5 years. I passed the Louisiana bar on the first time. I say that to say because I applied to 7 law schools, but only got into one. And, you know, Seton Hall, and I got through Seton Hall's affirmative action program, right? Mm-hmm. It was like the LEO program, I think Legal Education Opportunities. And I thought, you know, when I got into law school, I was so excited, but I thought they made a mistake, right? Because I had gotten 6 rejection letters. And then I remember I lived in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, getting off the subway, walking home, and seeing this big envelope in the mailbox. And I was like, damn, you know, Seton Hall wastes a lot of paper that said you didn't get in, right? And I open it up and it says, congratulations. I'm like, nah, this can't be. And then, you know, I read it like 10 times, and sure enough, I got into law school. I was so excited. I put the acceptance letter in my backpack, and I kept it my whole first semester, mm-hmm. because I was so afraid somebody was going to come up to me and say, we made a mistake, like, you don't belong here. And I was going to be able to pull out my application and be like, well, it's too late. You already let me in, you know? But that was like my mindset. You know, I don't have any attorneys in my family, in my immediate family. I did live with my cousin in Brooklyn, and she was a public defender, or she is a public defender today. Now she works at the Staten Island Legal Aid Office, but she worked in the Bronx for a while in Manhattan Legal Aid Society. So, you know, I was nervous. You know, I felt out of place, just kind of with all those rejections and then finally getting accepted. And when you get those rejections, it's like, no, you're not supposed to be an attorney, right? You're not supposed to go to law school. But I get to Seton Hall, and I was very, very thankful for the LEO program that I got into, and I made a ton of great connections with the other students of color and minority students that were there. But that small little group was like the majority of the diversity at the law school. And that kind of became frustrating, particularly when we were in con law and we're talking about affirmative action. And, you know, like in con law, you just have those weeks, like you have the abortion case week, you have the affirmative action case week. And, you know, we're on affirmative action. I'm one of 2 people of color, 2 black people in that class. And my constitutional professor, his name was Mark Alexander, did a really great job of like fostering this dialogue. And he's a black man himself. And I just remember he not wanting me to have to, you know, be the voice of reason and combat all these other students in the classroom and like why we need affirmative action. Right. But that's what it kind of came out to be, because the other person, for whatever reason, didn't want to like help me out in this battle with all these other kids who were talking about how we don't need affirmative action. And so I got beat up pretty well the first day with all these students like making all these points against affirmative action. And the second day I come in with like some statistics. I'm like, all right, so the largest recipients of affirmative action are white women. We look in this classroom, like, you know, there are some white women in this classroom who are here because of affirmative action, but they probably don't want to tell you about it, right? Everyone looks to me because they think I got an affirmative action, which I did, but they didn't know. until the debate continued into the cafeteria. It was me and this kid, Ezra, just kind of going back and forth. And Ezra and I actually respected each other. Mm-hmm. We had different opinions, but we were able to, like, respectfully debate.
Right.
And we're in the cafeteria, we're going back and forth. And, like, his closing point was, like, you didn't need affirmative action to get into Seton Hall. And I was like, yeah, I did, right? And that just, like, dented it. Because what people don't understand is we all have different life experiences. We mm-hmm. all have different, like, resources. We all have different supports. And the way I got to law school doesn't make me any less of a student, doesn't make me any less of an attorney, right? Because I passed the bar, mm-hmm. and I've been representing people for 4 years. And being at Seton Hall, there was a challenge with the lack of diversity that was there. I started off as a part-time student, transferred into the full-time program. And when I graduated, I was it was me and Uche that were the only two full-time black males that graduated in my class. That was terrible. And I think we talk about how we can increase diversity in law schools. It's difficult, but it needs to be intentional. I don't think it's impossible. And so I've had conversations with some of the, you know, the folks at Seton Hall and things that they can be doing to increase the diversity. And I think they have actually listened to some of those recommendations. But it was disheartening just for Uche and I to be the only two black males to graduate from the full-time program that year. I knew about law school in undergrad. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't very accessible to me, like just the idea of law school. And so I think for certain families and where there are, you know, lawyers in the family, they can kind of talk about the LSAT whole application process, the purpose of the LSAT, and not having to navigate those waters by yourself is tremendously helpful. So being more intentional about those pre-law programs, mm-hmm. getting more students to actually, you know, undergrad students to come to the law school, sit in on classes, get a feel for what this experience is going to be like. Because sitting in the classroom, I think will excite a lot more people to actually, you know, want to apply to law school. And additionally, I think they need to be highlighting more on what you can do with your law degree. Unfortunately, Seton Hall, not unfortunately, fortunately, Seton Hall is a good law school for, like, health law, and that's one of the things that they were constantly priding themselves on, but I don't have any interest in health law, right? I went into law school because I knew I wanted to be a public defender, and so I kind of had to create that experience. They had some opportunities for me. They have a juvenile justice clinic, which I was able to participate in. Additionally, I was the Center for Social Justice Scholar, so I got to participate in different clinics in that way. Mm-hmm. But that's not what the law school was known for. So I think law schools should definitely pride themselves on the faculty and reputation they have in certain areas of the law, but be mindful that in doing so might, you know, turn some people off to think that, well, if I want to be a civil rights lawyer, or if I want to be a public defender, or if I want to be a prosecutor, then this law school is not for me. There was always law firms, like, sponsoring these receptions, and, like, that's cool. But, like, I'm not going to be in that firm life. Right? I want to represent people. And there weren't enough partnerships with, like, the public defender's office sponsoring receptions, or the prosecutor's office sponsoring receptions. And I think if you get a more diverse crew of sponsors for those receptions or for those career fairs, that will do more justice and have more reach to students who might not align with whatever reputation that law school might have.
Will spent the summer of 2012 as a law clerk for OPD, where he became energized for the work that lay ahead of him.
Yeah, so 2013, September, I think the Tuesday after Labor Day was my first day. And I was a law clerk the summer 2012, so the summer before, the year before. And as a law clerk, I really got exposed to just, like, the tremendous amount of civil rights violations that are happening in New Orleans. And I remember having a conversation with G. Park, who used to be the deputy chief here at the public defender's office. And when I was here in 2012, she was the director of the special litigation department. And I was her law clerk, and we just had kind of conversations about the tremendous amount of violations and civil rights violations and ordinary injustices that are taking place here. That we need people to try to help prevent that. And I learned over the course of that summer, like, you know, why Louisiana is one of the prison capitals of the world. I got to see it with my own eyes. And I came here because they're simply locking up too many black people. And I wanted to be in an office that was trying to help, you know, change that statistic. And sitting in the courtroom for the first time when I was a law clerk and seeing these black and brown people coming in orange jumpsuits, coming in silver chains around their wrists, that are then shackled to chains that are around their waist, that are connected to chains that are around their feet, I was absolutely shocked. And that sound of the links just like rubbing up against each other and the shuffle of the feet is something that I will never forget. I don't know what slavery sounds like, but I'm sure it's similar to that. And being exposed to, you know, just that reality in New Orleans, I was like, this is where I need to be a public defender. Mm-hmm. And so I graduated, came down, and started working in September of 2013 and have been here ever since.
As Will pointed out, Louisiana is known as the incarceration capital of the world. It has the highest per capita incarceration rate in the United States, nearly double the national average. One of the many factors feeding into the swelling prison population is the state's habitual offender statute, which increases the sentence for people who have been previously convicted of felonies. Will spoke more on the challenges this poses for public defenders.
I think it is the antiquated laws that we have on the books, particularly the habitual offender statute, that has most recently had some reform, August 1st, 2017. But before that, it simply did not differentiate between violent and nonviolent offenders. So one of my first cases as a first-year attorney, client starts the nickel bag of weed because he has prior felony convictions, prior marijuana convictions. He's facing 20 years to life. Mm-hmm. And as somebody who's been out of law school for 6 months, and you're having to represent somebody with that exposure, that is, you know, soul crushing in the amount of responsibility that's given to you to represent this person with that amount of exposure. Mm-hmm. So I think having to be in a position where you came to do this work, to fight for people, to be their champion, to, you know, get them back to their families as quickly as possible. When your hands are tied because of the habitual offender statute, that forces so many people to take plea deals because their exposure at trial, if they lose, is so great. And so, you know, we to this day have cases where, you know, it's a triable case, or there are good issues to litigate, or the people are just factually innocent, but don't want to take the risk in going to trial and losing because of what their exposure might be. So I think the habitual offender statute really makes it difficult to practice here. And I think that the district attorney, Leon Cannizzaro, the way he runs his office, I think is not consistent with making the city safer. You know, I've been able to see disparate treatment between the people I represent and people who have private attorneys. I've been able to see the way white defendants get diversion and, you know, people of color that I represent get probation. I've been able to see that over these last 4 years, and I've been able to have conversations with Mr. Cannizzaro about trying to have special consideration for one of my clients who I don't think is like maybe some of the other people who've come before him and just simply not get it. Mm-hmm. And I have to go to trial, right? And the story I'm thinking about is Raymond Blanchard. Well, he's actually not up there, but I have pictures of clients, you know, that I've gone to trial or, you know, won some type of hearing to get them back to their free world. I'm thinking of Raymond Blanchard, who was 23 years old, had never been arrested in New Orleans. And that's kind of an anomaly. He had his high school diploma. That's an anomaly for typically the people that come through representation of the public defender's office. You know, he had his high school diploma. He had some school at ITT Tech, had his TWIC card, which is like an occupational license to do work offshore, had never been in trouble. And literally, he's charged with armed robbery with a firearm. But that particular incident was, you know, a mental health breakdown. And you could see that on the body camera. And as I tried to explain that to Mr. Cannizzaro and really have him understand the human and the person of who Raymond was, it was just like falling on deaf ears. And I was unsuccessful in convincing him to give us a more appropriate plea deal. His mom and his cousin came in and had a conversation with Mr. Cannizzaro, and they were unsuccessful. The victim in the case who knew my client told the assistant district attorney that this was a misunderstanding. I don't want to prosecute I would give Raymond his job back at Dini's Seafood today if he gets out of jail. And for whatever reason, they wanted to go forward with a plea offer of 10 years. Right? Wow. And he's facing 15 to 99. And in that situation, it wasn't my pride, but it was more so like my absolute, you know, willingness to try to have some fairness for Raymond. And in my inability, not inability, but my like reluctance to just lay down and accept whatever garbage they were trying to give us, knowing that he gives better deals to people in different situations all the time.
Right.
So we ended up calling ready for trial, went to trial with Tina Peng, who's an attorney here. And halfway through voir dire, the complaining witness is at the prosecutor's office, just gets up and leaves. Because he's telling them that he doesn't want to go to trial. They're wasting his time. He doesn't want Raymond in jail. So gets up and leaves. And I got word of that. So I'm trying to get through this jury selection to swear in the jury. Because once the jury is sworn in, jeopardy attaches. And if he's gone, then they can't try him again. Unfortunately, I think we only got to about 9. They dismissed the case, but then they reinstitute. Basically starting the clock over. But Raymond was able to get out before a bond was set. We're able to negotiate the plea down to probation like we wanted. And Raymond is working 2 jobs and he's doing fine.
The criminal justice reform package passed by the Louisiana legislature in June of this year included a change to the habitual offender law, which took effect on November 1st. Before, prosecutors could file a bill against someone charged with a felony if they had prior felony convictions, which forced judges to impose additional mandatory minimum sentences on those found guilty, regardless of the nature of the crime. This led to decades-long sentences for nonviolent offenses, and in the worst instances, sometimes life. In 2013, an ACLU study found that nearly 80% of prisoners in Louisiana sentenced to life without parole received that sentence for nonviolent drug crimes. While the habitual offender law is still on the books, the new version removes the mandatory sentencing guidelines in some cases, which allows judges to shorten or suspend sentences at their discretion. If the new law works as intended, the number of nonviolent offenders serving long terms should decline over time. Sadly, the law is not retroactive. Prisoners serving cruelly long sentences, often for nothing more than being addicted to an illegal substance and repeatedly getting caught with it, will not see the effects of the new legislation. Like many public defense offices nationwide, Orleans Public Defenders is severely underfunded. However, what makes the office's financial situation particularly dire is the unstable source from which most of their funding flows, revenue from traffic tickets. According to the Louisiana Public Defender Board's 2016 annual report, for every traffic case filed in a district court, the district public defender's office receives $45, a $10 increase from $35 as of 2015. In recent years, the number of ticket filings has decreased substantially, resulting in nearly $8.5 million less to public defender offices statewide. Despite this decrease, local revenues still account for most of the funding for public defense in the state, with only 35% of the funding coming from state budget.
But also just think about how irresponsible that is to try to fund this constitutional right based upon enforcing traffic tickets in the sense of, what if you have a year where everybody just obeys the traffic laws and like there's not one ticket written? Right. So what does that mean for us? And that's another problem, the different like financial conflicts of interest that are codified in the criminal justice system. That's another conversation.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just irresponsible to fund, to have that be like a main source of funding for a public defender office.
In January 2016, Chief Public Defender Derwin Bunton made the strategic decision to refuse to take on more felony cases in an attempt to underscore his office's desperate need for more funding.
So I think in 2016, we were in a period of restriction of services, and we, as an office, take our responsibility of representing the people of New Orleans very seriously. And when our caseload gets to an amount where we can't provide effective representation, we don't want to provide, you know, ineffective assistance of counsel. And so Chief Bunton decided that we needed to prove, or not prove a point, but take a stance and saying, have a fully funded public defender office so we can represent these people adequately. Over the course of that strategy, we were able to get more funding, which allowed us to hire some lateral attorneys and then work down our wait list. But that comes at a price, and that price was people sitting in jail without attorneys. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about what our responsibility as public defenders are, it is to represent the people who can't afford attorneys. And we had to put people on wait lists and refuse cases to demonstrate that we needed more funding to represent these people. And it was difficult to do. Mm-hmm. I saw clients that I had represented in the past, you know, call out to me and say, will we take my case? And I'm like, damn, yeah, I'll take it, but I can't. Like, I would love to represent you again, but I can't because of what we're doing. And it was tough, you know, especially when you want to represent as many people as you can. But strategically as an office, we had to take a stand to demonstrate why we needed more funding. So now in 2017, we aren't refusing cases anymore. We still are in like a certain degree of restriction of services, but it's mainly for putting cases on a wait list that are what we classify as level 5 cases, which are your second degree murders, your aggravated rapes, your aggravated kidnappings, things along those lines, and conflict cases. So when we need to get somebody a conflict attorney, there'll be a little bit of a wait list for that because we need to reach out to the attorneys, see what those conflict panel attorneys' case capacity is so we can make the appropriate assignments.
Will is a firm believer in the power of juries, so much so that he founded his own nonprofit, the Juror Project. I asked Will to talk more about the mission of his organization and what he hopes to accomplish through it.
Yeah, so in 2015, I think I did maybe around 5 jury trials. Mm-hmm. And what was very frustrating to me was seeing the original panels of jurors come in and being somewhat representative of New Orleans, not entirely representative of New Orleans, but seeing that we had some diversity. And then after the voir dire process, the juries lost a lot of diversity. And particularly, I did a trial with Carrie Ellis, who's the training director here at OPD. And the individual we represented was charged with, I think, maybe possession of a couple rocks of crack cocaine and a couple of pills. I don't remember the names of the pills that he didn't have a prescription for. And so we're doing voir dire, and this older black guy responds to one of the prosecutor's questions, saying, you know, I can't vote guilty for this man because he's only charged with possession of some drugs. He's not hurting anybody, you know, and something along the lines of, I don't think we should continue to lock up drug addicts and people with substance abuse issues. And in my mind, I was like, yes, oh, I love you, right? But then you say something like that and you get kicked off the jury.
Right.
And so when he said that, it gave license for so many other people to agree with him. And what I found over the variety of those trials is we would have jurors that disagreed with the criminalization of the activity, disagree with the actual sentence that would be given out. And then you have the people who just don't want to be there, right? And I just thought if these people knew the disservice that they actually were doing in getting themselves, not getting themselves kicked off, but like if they had more information about how we need their perspectives in the jury room more than anyone else's, then they would view this opportunity differently. There's so many things that I couldn't say in that moment, right? And I've done trials and I've supervised trials where, you know, somebody's charged with possession of heroin, they're facing life in prison, or they're charged with, you know, whatever the felony might be. And I know what the sentencing range is, but the jurors won't know. And I, you know, if they only knew that this person would be getting 49 and a half years, they probably would think differently about voting guilty for this top charge, right? Maybe they consider something lesser, or if the person was just factually innocent, then they vote not guilty. So in seeing this lack of information that these people had, I thought, and just like how that produced an unfair trial for my client, I thought, well, I need to be doing more in representing these people because this courtroom is like a boxing ring. And I have one hand tied behind my back. And if I'm going to have one hand tied behind my back, I need to figure out how I can better prepare for this fight. And so for me, that meant having conversations in the community with folks about the importance of jury duty, just generally, and the impact diversity can have in the deliberation room. And so it just started off as frustration from these people getting kicked off the jury to hey, let me educate you guys about what's really going on. And we talk about how everybody's entitled to a fair cross-section of their community. But we have a system that promotes a particular ideology that's allowed to sit on that jury. Or we have a system that promotes a particular person of a particular socioeconomic status that's more feasible for them to sit on the jury. And that's not fair, because that's not what our community has. Our community has a variety of people. When we talk about diversity, it's not just diversity of race, it's diversity of background, diversity of experience, and diversity of ideology. There are some, you know, liberal folks who have criticisms of the criminal justice system. They get on the called for jury during jury selection, they voice their opinions, and they get kicked off. Right. Well, I think we need to be having a conversation about how that opinion, you know, my client is entitled to that opinion in the jury deliberation room, but the pitfalls of this system is it removes certain folks. And so it's just categorically unfair. And I think as public defenders, it's our responsibility to do everything that we can to ensure that our clients' rights are being protected and that the fairness of the system that we're kind of walking with them through is as fair as possible. So the Juror Project for me, you know, the two main goals is to increase diversity of jury panels and improve people's perspective of jury duty. And those are the two goals, because with more diversity, the research demonstrates there's more fairness. Mm-hmm. And when we have people with a more positive perspective of this civic duty, I think that will lead to more positive outcomes of fairness. What it's looked like so far has been me traveling near and far, having conversations about jury duty, right? So giving presentations like I did for the law clerks yesterday, creating a jury duty unit plan for high school civic teachers to use in their classrooms, going to public defenders' offices across the country, training other public defenders on how to give presentations like this in their communities, giving implicit bias trainings to prosecutors and public defenders in a room, and really just kind of educating people about this process and about this system, particularly for those who aren't connected to it in any way, and empower an individual that you as a DJ or you as a plumber, or you as a teacher, or you as a person who's unemployed and have absolutely no connection to this criminal justice system, it can and will probably affect your community in some way, but you can be part of it through jury service and make a difference if you're able to participate. So New Orleans is 60% Black, 30% White, 5% Latino, and 3% Asian. Mm-hmm. I would say that I've more commonly seen the racial makeup be 60% White and like 40% Black. There have been some instances where there was a majority Black juries kind of in line with the demographics of the city. But I think my experiences have been a majority of them being white, like a 60% range, and that 40% people of color, mm-hmm. which is not reflective of the actual population of the city. And we think about why that might be, and there are a couple of factors. One is we call jurors, we call New Orleanians to serve on a jury from DMV records and voter registration records. Mm-hmm. On their face, those are race, quote unquote, race neutral databases. But we know that not everybody registers to vote, and we know that not everybody has the privilege to own a vehicle and have a driver's license, right? So if we are only using those two sources of lists, we are excluding a large population of New Orleanians. And I don't think that those two lists properly capture all the diversity of New Orleans. So I think we could do a better job in increasing the lists. You know, we could use maybe like tax assessor lists or utility bills or whatever might be more inclusive of the city to actually have the proper representation of diversity in the jury lounge. So I think we kind of start at a disadvantage just by the lists that we use. But then we have individuals who, you know, will say things that demonstrate they don't want to be there. And I've had, you know, jurors, people of color, I've had conversations with during voir dire who will cite, due to their religion, you know, they can't sit in judgment of another individual. Mm. And so I can't in that moment convince this churchgoer that the Bible actually promotes this type of service. I'm just not that well versed in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And so to tackle that conversation, I partner with pastors and people at churches to send the message. And when you have a pastor articulating why our faith or why their faith actually promotes this type of service, that's one way that we can address that population who tries to get out of jury duty by citing, you know, their religion. Then we have so we have people with, you know, religious reasons, they get removed. We have people who mention their inability to convict based on, you know, a disagreement with the sentence or a disagreement with the criminality that or the behavior that's being criminalized. And so after this voir dire process, that's what causes the lack of diversity because, you know, the system doesn't allow for this diverse sense of ideologies or diverse sense of perspectives to actually serve on a jury. And I just wholeheartedly disagree with that notion. I think the people we represent are entitled to the person that loves New Orleans Police Department just as much as the person who does not like or does not love New Orleans Police Department. And in fact, we actually want that because we know when those two people get in a room and they deliberate, they're going to challenge each other. And we as a society can have so much more faith in the decision that these two people make when they're judging the behavior of the police officers. Right. And so we really need to change the conversation about how we are selecting jurors and who actually gets to be in that room, because it's having a direct impact on the fairness of our criminal justice system.
Will has traveled around the country giving implicit bias trainings, even to prosecutors. I was interested in what their reaction was to the idea that they too harbored biases.
So locally, I've had some prosecutors tell me that what I'm doing is borderline illegal, which I just completely disagree. Mm-hmm. This is an educational mission. I'm promoting good government. I'm promoting good, you know, a fairer criminal justice system. When I've given presentation, I gave an implicit bias training with the Perception Institute to public defenders in Minneapolis and prosecutors in Minneapolis. And actually, they were very, it wasn't a juror project presentation, it was specifically an implicit bias training. But given the reputation of Louisiana being one of the prison capitals of the world, the prosecutors there were very resistant to like what I was saying. And specifically, they, you know, said something along the lines of, well, this isn't Louisiana, right? And so trying to discredit everything that I was saying because of the city that I was from. You know, I didn't agree with them. And I think when we are teaching people about unconscious bias or implicit bias, people with this egalitarian mindset are the hardest ones to convince that they have these biases. Right. Because they think that they could never, you know, participate in treating someone differently because of, you know, where they're from or what they look like or what their accent is or whatever might be triggering that bias. But it is in fact true, and the research demonstrates that we do all have these biases, and it's because of a number of reasons. You know, some of them, we have these seeds that are subliminally planted in our minds through media developing these biases, and they're growing, and we're not watering them, but they're growing every time we see some nonsense on TV. I shared this with the implicit bias training. And it's just a story of mine being a public defender, doing first appearances, which is the process in which people are first arrested. They get brought in front of a judge. Public defender gets assigned if the person's entitled to a public defender, and we make bond arguments. And in magistrate court, there's maybe three or four rows. We call it the box, and that's where the inmates sit. In the first row, there's, you know, when the particular day that I was there, in the first row, there are, they'd say, six black men in orange jumpsuits and in chains. In the second row, there are six more black men in orange jumpsuits and in chains. And then in the third row, there's five black women, and there's one in orange jumpsuits and in chains. And then there's one elderly white woman who was in an orange jumpsuit and in chains, but just seemed so out of place to me. And we didn't speak right away, but the look on her face was, get me the hell out of here. And in my mind, I was like, what are you doing here? Right? Like, who made a mistake in arresting this old white lady? You know? So I interviewed everybody in the first row, second row. When I finally got to her, she told me, you know, how she kind of winded up here. And she was visiting from St. Louis. She was about to hop on a carnival cruise in the port of New Orleans. And they run your name before you hop on that ship. because you're technically leaving the country. Mm-hmm. And she was down here with like three of her girlfriends from New Orleans, I mean, from St. Louis, about to go on this cruise. And a warrant popped up when they ran her name. And she had a warrant from St. Louis for like issuing a bad check. And she explained to me that she must not have balanced her checkbook right. And, you know, our generation, like, we don't balance checkbooks. It's like Venmo, not PayPal. My skill set. You know, we just have the app on our phone.
Yeah.
But, and actually, I didn't do this intentionally, but, you know, my mom had a checkbook. You know, so I knew about checkbooks and balancing it and whatnot. And in that moment, I was just like, you don't deserve to be here. Like, and she said, you know, I will pay whatever I didn't pay. Like, I'll pay that. And I wanted to do everything I could to get her out, right? She ended up getting a $50,000 bond and an extradition warrant. And I felt so bad for her. I couldn't do anything. But, like, looking at that experience, my implicit biases played a role in not associating criminality with this older white lady. And like majority of Americans, we have unconscious biases that associate black folks with criminality. And being a man of color, to have that realization, not only in real time, but when I took the implicit association test, it was something I was ashamed of.
Yeah.
And it wasn't something that I really wanted to believe, but I knew it was a reality because I trusted the research and what it had to represent. And being aware of that, I can now know like how my decisions could be influenced by these biases that I have, and not just associating criminality with a particular individual, but also associating like innocence with somebody else. And when we think about what my role and responsibility is as a public defender, it's to represent that person regardless if they're innocent or guilty. Like they have particular rights that I am tasked with protecting. And when we all become more aware of how our unconscious biases influence the way we protect these people, I think we can increase the quality of representation. It's like very hypocritical. Mm-hmm. And coming to terms with that and realizing that, I think, has made me have so much more perspective in the way I do my job.
In 1995, Professor Paul Butler, now a professor at Georgetown Law, published an article in the Yale Law Journal entitled "Racially Based Jury Nullification: Black Power in the Criminal Justice System." In it, Professor Butler made the radical argument that black jurors have a moral obligation to use nullification as a tool to acquit nonviolent offenders and send them back to the community. I asked Will whether his own philosophy on juror diversity meshed with that of Professor Butler's.
So I definitely agree with Professor Butler in the sense that we as a community need to be utilizing the concept of jury nullification more. And particularly, we need to be people of color need to be part of the conversation on who's getting sent to prison. For the longest, or actually no, originally prisons were supposed to be created for violent people, but that's not who's filling them now. And if we can understand that jury nullification was originally created as this constitutional premise to be a check on the government for preventing, to make sure they're not abusing their power, then we need to be doing our job. And if we think sending drug addicts is an abuse of their power, then nullify. If we think sending people to prison for armed robbery with a firearm, for stealing somebody's bicycle, then nullify, right? There are so many problems with the criminal justice system that people aren't realizing the power that they have to change it and to bring some type of reform. You don't need to be a lawyer. You don't need to be a governor. You don't need to be a legislator to have an impact on someone's life. And I think with the power of nullification, you can send a message to the legislature that we don't believe in criminalizing this this activity, or we don't agree with this particular sentence. And until you guys get it right, we're not going to be complicit in the system that you've created to make Louisiana one of the prison capitals of the world, or to increase the overall, you know, prison population in any state in this country. And I think, you know, we need to have an understanding of like what people are nullifying on. They're not nullifying on murder. They're not nullifying on rape. They're nullifying on the types of activity that shouldn't be criminalized, like drug addiction. That's a health problem. That's not a crime problem. We need to have a more thorough understanding of how we need to be treating these people, and we shouldn't be considering prison as the treatment they should be getting. We know that there are, you know, just looking at the research, that there's more fairness with more diversity. And when we think about the classic injustice that we can often cite is like an innocent person being convicted for a crime that they did not commit. And that's that offends everybody's traditional notions of fairness and justice. Like, an innocent person should not be convicted and serve time for something they simply did not do. In that same conversation, we should be talking about, when you convict an innocent person, the person who actually did commit the crime is still on the street. And we have to understand that if our criminal justice system does not work for the innocent, then it won't work for the guilty. Mm-hmm. And as a public defender, and as somebody who's running the Juror Project, I want to have a fair criminal justice system just like everybody else. I want to have a safe New Orleans just like everybody else. But I also understand the way that we have been going about trying to promote fairness in this state, trying to promote safety in this state by locking people up, simply has not been working.
I asked Will what advice he had for students looking to go into public defense, and on the other hand, if he had anything to share with students hoping to go into prosecution.
Never underestimate the impact that you can have, and never underestimate the change that you can make for a massive system that just seems like there's no hope. And, you know, I was very, very fortunate to have a life that I think bred me to be a public defender. And I have a tremendous mentor who guides me through this process. And so I think it's important to know, if you are doing an internship or an externship or a clerkship, really at the end of it, it's important for you to, like in the beginning, identify what you want to get out of this experience. And then your experience at summer, that internship, whatever it might be. And at the end, write down and realize what you learned from that experience, and then compare it to like what you expected. And I think that will allow you to get perspective over that particular profession, that particular organization, or that particular type of work. And I recommend people to do that, because I don't see public defense, like, I don't wake up and loathe going to work. Like, I love doing what I do. And I think it's important to find that passion, because when you don't, when you lose connection of like why you're doing something, then you're not going to be able to sustain the difficulties that can come with that. And so my recommendation for folks is to get mentorships, or get mentors if you can. And that's kind of easier said than done. And I remember in law school, I'm like, well, how do I get a mentor? Like, you just go up to somebody and say, hey, will you be my mentor? Like, this is like really weird. I think you kind of finesse that relationship with somebody that you respect in the profession, and don't underestimate the value that your professors can have, like during office hours. I really wish I took advantage of office hours, not for the sake of like learning, you know, contracts, although that probably would have been good too, but like for the sake of just like learning this professor's like trajectory and story. Like, they are this professor now, but what was it like for them in law school? What type of internships, externships, clerkships did they do? What was their first job out of law school? And getting exposed to a variety of experiences and opportunities so that you yourself will be able to consider what it is that you want to do with your degree. So I think we need good prosecutors, and I think we need good people on both sides of the aisle. You also, if you're going to become a prosecutor, you have to be responsible in the sense that the job isn't about you. It's about, you know, other people. And too often prosecutors, I guess everybody is, you know, can get consumed with their own ego. But I think it's important to understand what type of influence you can have as a prosecutor. Because, you know, certain offices like the district attorney's office here in New Orleans, the individual assistant district attorneys don't have any discretion. They don't have any power. All the plea deals have to get approved by the district attorney himself or the first assistant. And so if you, as a good prosecutor, are looking at a case and you really don't think that it merits prosecution, you don't, in most offices, you don't probably won't have the authority to just dismiss it yourself. So you have to understand, you know, that you have to be an advocate for justice and not necessarily just an employee of a prosecutor's office. And not lose sight of like how you can affect people's lives. I think too often when I'm having conversations with prosecutors and I say, hey, he's a dad, you know, he is a basketball coach, or he takes care of his mother. And they're just like, I don't want to hear all that. Or you know, the DA doesn't want to hear that. Like these are people. And I think when we lose sight of their humanity, we're really losing sight of like the purpose of our job. And not everybody was born. I don't know what the phrase is. Like everybody's kind of born. You're a baby, right? And these instances, these experiences over your lifetime have formed like who you are as a person, or have taught you certain lessons, and maybe didn't teach you certain things. And I think when we lose sight of how poverty and how just certain life circumstances influences the way people make decisions, you're just really just not having any type of empathy as a prosecutor. You're not having any type of understanding on like how to make the city safer. And I just think that's irresponsible. But I do think we need responsible prosecutors. We need empathetic prosecutors. And we need prosecutors that are working for fairness and working for justice.
Will shared a final anecdote about one of the most difficult cases he worked on, and how it revealed an important lesson about the urgency of his role as a public defender.
So the first time I cried as a public defender, I represented an individual named Ricky Carr, and he was charged with unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, which it's kind of a joke in my office. Like I am like the unauthorized use of a motor vehicle expert because I did like so many cases with this particular charge. But what was very frustrating for Mr. Carr's case is, you know, he was just factually innocent. He had been in jail way too long, and he said, I just want to get out. They're offering me probation. Let me take this probation and get out. And I said, no, just give me 3 more days that we're going to go to trial. We're going to prove your innocence, and then you'll be home free, and you won't have to worry about probation. The officer that arrested told me that at the motions hearing, he was actually high on pain medicine when he was testifying. And he had told the prosecutors that he can't testify because he just had shoulder surgery. And he said, you know, I don't really remember. Your guy never actually was driving the van. I had pulled up. No one was in the van. And like there were so much in his mind, so many circumstances that he didn't think they should be going forward with this charge. And I wanted to be able to bring that to the light of the jury and also just talk about how he didn't have the keys, he wasn't actually in the van, it wasn't on, he wasn't driving it, whatever. Due to like antics of the prosecutor, our jury was dismissed. They never got called up, I mean. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Carr was just frustrated. He said, you know, I've waited too long. I just want to get out. Like, just let me plead guilty and let me get out of here. And in that moment, I just felt like my purpose of being there was there was no purpose. Like, here is another young black kid pleading guilty. He's about to be on probation. He's been in jail for like 15 months. His grandmother is in the hallway asking, like, what's going on? Why is everybody like beating up on Ricky? Like, this doesn't make any sense. And I was just like in a position of feeling powerless. And when we as public defenders, you know, start to do this job, we think we're able to have some power in fighting for people that don't have any power. And in that moment, I realized that this system is so much bigger than me and I can only do so much. And it was very, very frustrating because I wanted to fight for him. But the way that the system had worn down on him and had created this crucible and built up all this pressure, it did exactly what it's designed to do, to get people to break and to plead guilty and no longer want to fight. And so seeing that in him, seeing the frustration in his grandmother and like his sisters, and like they're asking me like, what is going on? Like, why is he pleading guilty? And like, I didn't know what to tell them. And that was one of the real first experiences where I understood wholeheartedly that innocent people plead guilty all the time. And so I remember that case as being one of the most difficult cases because I had to kind of question like what I'm able to do as a public defender, what impact I'm able to have. And then I think about the people that I have been able to help. And I think about, you know, looking at Sterling Brumfield, or looking at Andrea Sherman, or Jairo Martinez, or Willard Perry, like all these people that I've been able to touch their lives in some form or fashion, and thinking that that was one less person that's locked up. That's one less person in that orange jumpsuit and silver chains looking like a slave. And knowing that I can have that impact on one individual's life, it's just like continually motivating for me, because I know there's so many more lives that we can be saving in a context and in a system that just does not care about them.
In our next episode, we'll talk to some attorneys from the Luzerne County Office of the Public Defender in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, about the opioid epidemic and the Kids for Cash scandal, in which local judges accepted kickbacks in exchange for sending thousands of children to nearby juvenile detention facilities. To hear more, tune in next time on Defenders United. Defenders United is produced by me, Gabriella Ferrara, a member of Georgetown Defenders and a contributor to the Georgetown Voice. Sound editing by Gustav Honnel-Stunkel. Research by Andrew Robinson. Theme music by Mike Pate, trial attorney at Legal Aid Brooklyn. Special thanks to Will Snowden and Orleans Public Defenders. Visit www.georgetowndefenders.wordpress.com for episode transcripts, photos, and more. Well, we're in the valley down so low.